to the top. The faculty mailboxes are still half empty, the mail piled in a bin. Moshimi goes to her mailbox to look for her class roster. Her box is empty, so she roots through the bin for her mail. As she picks up each piece of mail addressed to this or that faculty member or TA, she begins putting it into the appropriate box, matching name to name. Even after she's found her roster, she continues completing the task Alice left undone. The mindlessness soothes her nerves. As a child, she'd always had a knack for organization. She would take it upon herself to neaten closets and drawers, not only her own, but her parents' as well. She had organized the cutlery drawer, the refrigerator. These self-appointed tasks would occupy her during quiet, hot days of her summer vacation, and her mother would look on in disbelief, sipping watermelon sherbet in front of the fan. There are just a handful of items left in the bin. She bends over to pick them up, and then another name, a sender's name typed in the upper left-hand corner of a business-sized envelope, catches her eye. She takes the stapler and the letter and the rest of her things into her office. She shuts the door, sits at her desk. The envelope is addressed to a professor of comparative literature who teaches German as well as French. She opens the envelope. Inside she finds a cover letter and a resume. For a minute she simply stares at the name centered at the top of the resume, laser printed in an elegant font. She remembers the name, of course. The name alone, when she'd first learned it, had been enough to seduce her. Dimitri Desjardins. He pronounced Desjardins the English way, the S's intact. And in spite of her training in French, this is how she still thinks of it. Underneath the name is an address on West 164th Street. He is looking for an adjunct position, teaching German part-time. She reads through the resume, learns exactly where he's been and what he's done for the past decade. Travels in Europe, a job working with the BBC, articles and reviews published in Der Spiegel, critical inquiry, a PhD in German literature from the University of Heidelberg. She had met him years ago, in her final months of high school. It was a period in which she and two of her friends, in their eagerness to be college students, in desperation over the fact that no one their own age was interested in dating them, would drive to Princeton, loiter on the campus, browse in the college bookstore, do their homework in buildings they could enter without an ID. Her parents had encouraged these expeditions, believing she was at the library or attending lectures. They hoped she would go to Princeton for college, live with them at home. One day, as she and her friends were sitting on the grass, they were invited to join a student coalition from the university, a coalition protesting apartheid in South Africa. The group was planning a march on Washington, calling for sanctions. They took a chartered overnight bus to D.C. in order to be at the rally by early morning. Each of them had lied to their parents, claiming to be sleeping over at one another's homes. Everyone on the bus was smoking pot and listening to the same Crosby, Stills, and Nash album continuously, on a tape player running on batteries. Moshimi had been facing backward, leaning over and talking to her friends, who were in the two seats behind her, and when she turned back around, he was in the neighboring seat. He seemed aloof from the rest of the group, not an actual member of the coalition, somehow dismissive of it all. He was wiry, slight, with small downward-sloping eyes and an intellectual, ravaged-looking face that she found sexy, though not handsome. His hairline was already receding, his hair curly and fair. He needed a shave. His fingernails needed paring. He was wearing a white button-down shirt, faded Levi's with threadbare knees, pliable gold-framed spectacles that wrapped around his ears. Without introducing himself, he began talking to her, as if they were already acquainted. He was 27, had gone to Williams College, was a student of European history. He was taking a German course at Princeton now, living with his parents, both of whom taught at the university, and he was going out of his mind. He had spent the years after college traveling around Asia, Latin America. He told her he probably wanted to get a PhD eventually. The randomness of it all had appealed to her. He asked her what her name was, and when she told him, he had leaned toward her, cupping his ear, even though she knew he had heard it perfectly well. "How in the world do you spell that?" he had asked, and when she told him, he mispronounced it, as most people did. She corrected him, saying that Mo rhymed with toe, but he shook his head and said, "I'll just call you Mouse." The nickname had irritated and pleased her at the same time. It made her feel foolish, but she was aware that in renaming her, he had claimed her somehow, already made her his own. As the bus grew quiet, as everyone began to fall asleep, she had let him lean his head against her shoulder. Dmitri was asleep, or so she thought, and so she pretended to fall asleep too. After a while, she felt his hand on her leg, on top of the white denim skirt she was wearing, and then slowly, he began to unbutton the skirt. Several minutes passed between his undoing of one button and the next, his eyes closed all the while, his head still on her shoulder as the bus hurtled down the empty, dark highway. It was the first time in her life a man had touched her. She held herself perfectly still. She was desperate to touch him too, but she was terrified. Finally, Dmitri opened his eyes. She felt his mouth near her ear, and she turned to him, prepared to be kissed, at 17, for the very first time. But he had not kissed her. He had only looked at her and said, "You're going to break hearts, you know." And then he leaned back, in his own seat this time, removed his hand from her lap, and closed his eyes once again. She had stared at him in disbelief, angry that he assumed she hadn't broken any hearts yet, and at the same time, flattered. For the rest of the journey she kept her skirt unbuttoned, hoping he would return to the task. But he didn't touch her after that, and in the morning there was no acknowledgement of what had passed between them. At the demonstration, he had wandered off, paid her no attention. On the way back, they had sat apart. Afterwards, she returned to the university every day to try to run into him. After some weeks, she saw him striding across campus, alone, holding a copy of The Man Without Qualities. They shared some coffee and sat on a bench outside. He had asked her to see a movie, Godard's Alphaville, and to have Chinese food. She had worn an outfit that still causes her to wince, an old blazer of her father's that was too long for her, over jeans, the sleeves of the blazer rolled up as if it were a shirt, to reveal the striped lining inside. It had been the first date of her life, strategically planned on an evening her parents were at a party. She recalled nothing of the movie, had eaten nothing at the restaurant, part of a small shopping complex off Route 1. And then, after watching Dmitri eat both of their fortune cookies without reading either prediction, she had made her error. She had asked him to be her date to the senior prom. He had declined, driven her home, kissed her lightly on her cheek in the driveway, and then he never called her again. The evening had humiliated her. He had treated her like a child. Sometime over the summer, she bumped into him at the movies. He was with a date, a tall, freckled girl with hair to her waist. Moshumi had wanted to flee, but he'd made a point of introducing her to the girl. "This is Moshumi," Dmitri had said deliberately, as if he'd been waiting for the opportunity to say her name for weeks. He told her he was going to Europe for a while, and from the look on the date's face, she realized that she was going with him. Moshumi told him that she'd been accepted at Brown. "You look great," he told her when the date wasn't listening. While she was at Brown, postcards would arrive from time to time, envelopes plastered with colorful, oversized stamps. His handwriting was minuscule but sloppy, always causing her eyes to strain. There was never a return address. For a time, she carried these letters in her book bag, to her classes, thickening her agenda. Periodically, he sent her books he'd read and thought she might like. A few times he called in the middle of the night, waking her, and she spoke to him for hours in the dark, lying in bed in her dorm room, then sleeping through her morning classes. A single call kept her sailing for weeks. "I'll come visit you. I'll take you to dinner," he told her. He never did. Eventually, the letters tapered off. His last communication had been a box of books, along with several postcards he'd written to her in Greece and Turkey, but not managed to send at the time. And then she'd moved to Paris. She reads Dmitri's resume again, then the cover letter. The letter reveals nothing other than earnest pedagogical intent. Mentions a panel Dmitri and the professor to whom it's addressed attended some years ago. Practically the same letter exists in a file on her computer. His third sentence is missing a period, which she now carefully inserts with her finest nibbed fountain pen. She can't bring herself to write down his address, though she doesn't want to forget it. In the Xerox room, she makes a copy of the resume. She sticks it in the bottom of her bag. Then she types up a new envelope and puts the original in the professor's mailbox. As she returns to her office, she realizes there's no stamp or postmark on the new envelope, worries that the professor will suspect something. But she reassures herself that Dmitri could easily have delivered the letter personally. The idea of him standing in the department, occupying the same space she occupies now, fills her with the same combination of desperation and lust he's always provoked. The hardest part is deciding where to write down the phone number, in what part of her agenda. She wishes she had a code of some sort. In Paris, she had briefly dated an Iranian professor of philosophy who would write the names of his students in Persian on the backs of index cards, along with some small, cruel detail to help him distinguish among them. Once he read the cards to Moshumi. Bad skin, one said. Thick ankles, said another. Moshumi can't resort to such trickery, can't write in Bengali. She barely remembers how to write her own name, something her grandmother had once taught her. Finally, she writes it on the D page, but she doesn't include his name beside it. Just the numbers, disembodied, don't feel like a betrayal. They could be anybody's. She looks outside. As she sits down at her desk, her eye travels upward. The window in the office reaches the top of the wall, so that the rooftop of the building across the street stretches across the bottom edge of the sill. The view induces the opposite of vertigo, a lurching feeling inspired not by gravity's pull to earth, but by the infinite reaches of heaven. At home that night, after dinner, Moshumi hunts among the shelves in the living room she and Nikhil share. Their books have merged since they've gotten married. Nikhil had unpacked them all, and nothing is where she expects it to be. Her eyes pass over stacks of Nikhil's design magazines, thick books on Gropius and Le Corbusier. Nikhil, bent over a blueprint at the dining table, asks what she's looking for. Stendhal, she tells him. It's not a lie. An old modern library edition of The Red and the Black in English, inscribed to Mouse, Love Dimitri, he'd written. It was the one book he'd inscribed to her. Back then it was the closest thing she'd ever had to a love letter. For months she had slept with the book under her pillow, and later slipped it between her mattress and box spring. Somehow she managed to hold on to it for years. It's moved with her from Providence to Paris to New York, a secret talisman on her shelves that she would glance at now and again, still faintly flattered by its peculiar pursuit of her, and always faintly curious as to what had become of him. But now that she's desperate to locate the book, she's convinced that it won't be in the apartment, that maybe Graham had taken it by mistake when he'd moved out of their place on York Avenue. Or that it's in the basement of her parents' house, in one of the boxes she'd shipped there a few years ago, when her shelves were getting too full. She doesn't remember packing it from her old apartment, doesn't remember unpacking it when she and Nikhil moved in together. She wishes she could ask Nikhil if he's seen it, a small green, cloth-bound book missing its dust jacket, the title embossed in a rectangle of black on the spine. And then suddenly she sees it herself, sitting in plain view, on a shelf she had scanned a minute ago. She opens the book, sees the modern library emblem, the dashing naked torch-bearing figure. She sees the inscription, the force of the ballpoint pen he'd used slightly crimping the other side of the page. She'd abandoned the novel after the second chapter. Her place is still marked by a yellowing receipt for shampoo. By now she's read the book in French 3 times. She finishes Scott Moncrief's English translation within days, reading it at her desk in the department and in her carrel in the library. In the evenings at home, she reads it in bed until Nikhil comes in to join her. Then she puts it away and opens something else. She calls him the following week. By then she's dug up the postcards, saved in an unsealed, unmarked manila envelope in the box where she keeps her tax returns, and read them too, amazed that his words, the sight of his handwriting, still managed to discombobulate her. She tells herself she's calling an old friend. She tells herself the coincidence of finding his resume, of stumbling upon him in this way, is too great that anyone in her position would pick up the phone and call. She tells herself he could very well be married, as she is. Perhaps all four of them will go out to dinner, become great friends. Still, she doesn't tell Nikhil about the resume. One night in her office, after 7 o'clock, when only a janitor roams the halls, after a few sips from the small bottle of Maker's Mark she has stashed at the back of her file cabinet, she calls. A night, Nikhil thinks she's working on revisions for an article for PMLA. She dials the number, listens as it rings 4 times. She wonders if he'll even remember her. Her heart races, her finger moves to the cradle, ready to press down. Hello? It's his voice. Hi. Dimitri? Speaking. Who's this? She pauses. She can still hang up if she wants. It's Mouse. They begin seeing each other Mondays and Wednesdays, after she teaches her class. She takes the train uptown and they meet at his apartment, where lunch is waiting. The meals are ambitious. Poached fish, creamy potato gratin, golden puffed chickens roasted with whole lemons in their cavities. There is always a bottle of wine. They sit at a table with his books and papers and laptop pushed to one side. They listen to WQXR, drink coffee and cognac, and smoke a cigarette afterward. Only then does he touch her. Sunlight streams through large dirty windows into the shabby pre-war apartment. There are two spacious rooms, flaking plaster walls, scuffed parquet floors, towering stacks of boxes he has not yet bothered to unpack. The bed, a brand new mattress and box spring on wheels, is never made. After sex, they are always amazed to discover that the bed has moved several inches away from the wall, pushing up against the bureau on the other side of the room. She likes the way he looks at her when their limbs are still tangled together. Out of breath, as if he'd been chasing her, his expression anxious before relaxing into a smile. Some gray has come into Dimitri's hair and chest, some lines around the mouth and eyes. He's heavier than before, his stomach undeniably wide, so that his thin legs appear slightly comic. He recently turned 39. He has not been married. He does not seem very desperate to be employed. He spends his days cooking meals, reading, listening to classical music. She gathers that he has inherited some money from his grandmother. The first time they met, the day after she called him, at the bar of a crowded Italian restaurant near NYU, they had not been able to stop staring at each other, not been able to stop talking about the resume and the uncanny way it had fallen into Moshimi's hands. He had moved to New York only a month ago, had tried to look her up, but the phone is listed under Nickel's name. It didn't matter, they agreed. It was better this way. They drank glasses of Prosecco. She agreed to an early dinner with Dimitri that night, sitting at the bar of the restaurant, for the Prosecco had gone quickly to their heads. He had ordered a salad topped with warm lamb's tongue, a poached egg, and pecorino cheese, something she swore she would not touch, but ended up eating the better part of. Afterwards, she had gone to Balducci's to buy the pasta and ready-made vodka sauce she would have at home with Nikhil. On Monday and Wednesdays, no one knows where she is. There are no Bengali fruit sellers to greet her on the walk from Dimitri's subway stop, no neighbors to recognize her once she turns onto Dimitri's block. It reminds her of living in Paris. For a few hours at Dimitri's, she is inaccessible, anonymous. Dimitri is not terribly curious about Nikhil, does not ask her his name. He expresses no jealousy. When she told him in the Italian restaurant that she was married, his expression had not changed. He regards their time together as perfectly normal, as destined, and she begins to see how easy it is. Moshimi refers to Nikhil in conversation as my husband. My husband and I have a dinner to go to next Thursday. My husband's giving me this cold. At home, Nikhil suspects nothing. As usual, they have dinner, talk of their days. They clean up the kitchen together, then sit on the sofa and watch television while she corrects her students' quizzes and exercises. During the 11 o'clock news, they have bowls of Ben and Jerry's, then brush their teeth. As usual, they get into bed, kiss, then slowly they turn away from each other in order to stretch comfortably into sleep. Only Moshimi stays awake. Each Monday and Wednesday night, she fears that he will sense something, that he will put his arms around her and instantly know. She stays awake for hours after they've turned out the lights, prepared to answer him, prepared to lie to his face. She had gone shopping, she would tell him if he were to ask. For in fact, she had done this on her way home that first Monday, halting her journey back from Dimitri's in midstream, getting out of the subway at 72nd Street before continuing downtown, stopping in a store she'd never been in, buying a pair of the most ordinary-looking black shoes. One night, it's worse than usual. It's 3 o'clock, then 4. Construction work has been taking place for the past few nights on their street. Giant bins of rubble and concrete are moved and crushed, and Moshimi feels angry at Nikhil for being able to sleep through it. She's tempted to get up, pour herself a drink, take a bath, anything, but fatigue keeps her in bed. She watches the shadows that the passing traffic throws onto their ceiling, listens to a truck wailing in the distance like a solitary nocturnal beast. She is convinced she will be up to see the sunrise, but somehow she falls asleep again. She is woken just after dawn by the sound of rain beating against the bedroom window, pelting it with such ferocity that she almost expects the glass to shatter. She has a splitting headache. She gets out of bed and parts the curtains, then returns to bed and shakes Nikhil awake. Look, she says, pointing at the rain, as if it were something truly extraordinary. Nikhil obliges, fully asleep, sits upright, then closes his eyes again. At 7:30, she gets out of bed. The morning sky is clear. She walks out of the bedroom and sees that the rain has leaked through the roof. left an unsightly yellow patch on the ceiling and puddles in the apartment, one in the bathroom, another in the front hall. The sill of a window left open in the living room is soaked, streaked with mud, as are the bills and books and papers piled on it. The sight of it makes her weep. At the same time, she's thankful that there's something tangible for her to be upset about. "Why are you crying?" Nikhil asks, squinting at her in his pajamas. "There are cracks in the ceiling," she says. Nikhil looks up. "They're not too bad. I'll call the super. The rainwater came right through the roof." "What rain?" "Don't you remember? It was pouring rain at dawn. It was incredible. I woke you." But Nikhil doesn't remember a thing. A month of Mondays and Wednesdays passes. She begins to see him on Fridays as well. One Friday she finds herself alone in Dimitri's apartment. He goes out as soon as she arrives to buy a stick of butter for a white sauce he is making to pour over trout. Bartok plays on the stereo, expensive components scattered on the floor. She watches him from the window, walking down the block, a small, balding, unemployed, middle-aged man who is enabling her to wreck her marriage. She wonders if she is the only woman in her family ever to have betrayed her husband, to have been unfaithful. This is what upsets her most to admit, that the affair causes her to feel strangely at peace, the complication of it calming her, structuring her day. After the first time, washing up in the bathroom, she'd been horrified by what she'd done, at the sight of her clothes scattered throughout the two rooms. Before leaving, she'd combed her hair in the bathroom mirror, the only one in the apartment. She'd kept her head bent low, glancing up only briefly at the end. When she did, she saw that it was one of those mirrors that was for some reason particularly flattering, due to some trick of the light or the quality of the glass, causing her skin to glow. There is nothing on Dimitri's walls. He is still living out of a series of mammoth duffel bags. She is glad not to be able to picture his life in all its detail, its mess. The only things he's set up are the kitchen, the stereo components, and some of his books. Each time she visits, there are modest signs of progress. She wanders around his living room, looks at the books he's beginning to organize on his plywood shelves. Apart from all the German, their personal libraries are similar. There is the same lime-green spine of the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, the same edition of Mimesis, the same box set of Proust. She pulls out an oversized volume of photographs of Paris by Atche. She sits on an armchair, Dimitri's only piece of living room furniture. It was here that she had sat the first time she'd visited, and he'd stood behind her, massaging a spot on her shoulder, arousing her, until she stood up and they'd walked together to the bed. She opens the book to regard the streets and the landmarks she once knew. She thinks of her wasted fellowship. A large square of sunlight appears on the floor. The sun is directly behind her, and the shadow of her head spreads across the thick, silken pages, a few strands of her hair strangely magnified, quivering, as if viewed through a microscope. She leans back her head, closes her eyes. When she opens them a moment later, the sun has slipped away, a lone sliver of it now diminishing into the floorboards, like the gradual closing of a curtain, causing the stark white pages of the book to turn gray. She hears Dimitri's footsteps on the stairs, then the clean sound of his key in the lock, slicing sharply into the apartment. She gets up to put the book away, searching for the gap in which it had stood. Chapter 11. Gogol wakes up late on a Sunday morning, alone, from a bad dream he cannot recall. He looks over at Moshumi's side of the bed, at the untidy pile of books and magazines on the end table, the bottle of lavender room spray she likes to squirt sometimes on their pillows, the tortoiseshell barrette with strands of her hair caught in its clasp. She's at another conference this weekend in Palm Beach. By tonight, she'll be home. She claims she'd told him about the conference months ago, but he doesn't remember. "Don't worry," she'd said as she was packing. "I won't be there long enough to get a tan." But when he'd seen her bathing suit on top of the clothing on the bed, a strange panic had welled up inside of him as he thought of her lying without him by a hotel pool, her eyes closed, a book at her side. "At least one of us isn't cold," he thinks to himself now, crossing his arms tightly in front of his chest. Since yesterday afternoon, the building's boiler has been broken, turning the apartment into an icebox. Last night he'd had to turn the oven on in order to tolerate being in the living room, and he'd worn his old Yale sweatpants, a thick sweater over a t-shirt, and a pair of rag-wool socks to bed. He throws back the comforter and the extra blanket he'd placed on top of it in the middle of the night. He couldn't find the blanket at first, nearly called Moshmi at the hotel to ask where she kept it. But by then it was nearly 3 in the morning, and so, eventually, he'd hunted it down himself. Found it wedged on the top shelf of the hall closet, an unused wedding gift still in its zippered plastic case. He gets out of bed, brushes his teeth with freezing cold water from the tap, decides to skip shaving. He pulls on jeans and an extra sweater, and Moshimi's bathrobe over that, not caring how ridiculous he looks. He makes a pot of coffee, toasts some bread to eat with butter and jam. He opens the front door and retrieves the Times, removing the blue wrapper, putting it on the coffee table to read later. There's a drawing for work he must complete by tomorrow, a cross-section for a high school auditorium in Chicago. He unrolls the plan from his tube and spreads it out on the dining table, securing the corners with paperback books he grabs off the bookcase. He puts on his Abbey Road CD, skipping ahead to songs that would have been on side 2 of the album, and tries to work on the drawing, making sure his measurements correspond to the principal designer's notes. But his fingers are stiff, and so he rolls up the plan, leaves a note for Moshimi on the kitchen counter, and goes into the office. He's glad to have an excuse to be out of the apartment, instead of waiting for her at some point this evening to return. It feels milder outside, the air pleasantly damp, and instead of taking the train, he walks the 30 blocks up Park Avenue and over to Madison. He is the only person at the office. He sits in the darkened drafting room, surrounded by the desks of his co-workers, some piled with drawings and models, others as neat as a pin. He crouches over his table, a single pool of light from a swinging metal lamp illuminating the large sheet of paper. Tacked to the wall over his desk is a tiny calendar showing the entire year, which is coming once again to a close. At the end of the week, it will be the 4th anniversary of his father's death. Circled dates indicate all his deadlines, past and future. Meetings, site visits, conferences with clients. A lunch with an architect who's interested possibly in hiring him. He's eager to move to a smaller firm, to have some domestic commissions, to work with fewer people. Next to the calendar, there is a postcard of a Duchamp painting he has always loved, of a chocolate grinder that reminds him of a set of drums suspended against a gray background. Several post-it notes. The photograph of his mother and Sonia and himself at Fatehpur Sikri, salvaged from his father's refrigerator door in Cleveland. And next to this, a picture of Moshimi, an old passport photo he'd found and asked to keep. She's in her early 20s, her hair loose, her heavy-lidded eyes slightly lowered, looking to one side. It was taken before he'd begun to date her, when she was living in Paris, a time in her life in which he was still goggle to her, a remnant from her past, with little likelihood of appearing in her future. And yet they had met. After all her adventures, it was he whom she had married, he with whom she had shared her life. Last weekend was Thanksgiving. His mother and Sonia and Sonia's new boyfriend Ben had come, along with Moshimi's parents and brother, and they had all celebrated the holiday together in New York, crowded together in Gogol and Moshimi's apartment. It was the first time he had not gone to either his parents or to his in-laws for a holiday. It felt strange to be hosting, to assume the center of responsibility. They had ordered a fresh turkey in advance from the farmer's market, planned the menu out of food and wine, bought folding chairs so that everyone would have a place to sit. Moshimi had gone out and bought a rolling pin, made an apple pie for the first time in her life. For Ben's sake, they had all spoken in English. Ben is half Jewish, half Chinese, raised in Newton, close to where Gogol and Sonia grew up. He is an editor at the Globe. He and Sonia met by chance at a cafe on Newbury Street. Seeing them together, sneaking into the hallway so that they could kiss freely, holding hands discreetly as they sat at the table, Gogol had been oddly envious, and as they had all sat eating their turkey and roasted sweet potatoes and cornbread stuffing and the spiced cranberry chutney his mother had made, he looked at Moshimi and wondered what was wrong. They didn't argue, they still had sex, and yet he wondered. Did he still make her happy? She accused him of nothing, but more and more he sensed her distance, her dissatisfaction, her distraction. But there had been no time to dwell on this worry.
The weekend had been exhausting.
Getting their various family members to the apartments of nearby friends who were away and had given them keys. The day after Thanksgiving, they had all gone to Jackson Heights, to the halal butcher so that both their mothers could stock up on goat meat, and then to brunch. And on Saturday, there had been a concert of classical Indian music up at Columbia. Part of him wants to bring it up with her. "Are you happy you married me?" he would ask. But the fact he is even thinking of this question makes him afraid.
He finishes up the drawing, leaves it pinned on his desk to be reviewed in the morning. He's worked through lunch, and when he steps out of his office building, it is colder, the light fading rapidly from the sky. He buys a cup of coffee and a falafel sandwich at the Egyptian restaurant on the corner and walks south as he eats, towards the Flatiron and Lower Fifth Avenue, the twin towers of the World Trade Center looming in the distance, sparkling at the island's end. The falafel, wrapped in foil, is warm and messy in his hands. The stores are full, the windows decorated, the sidewalks crammed with shoppers. The thought of Christmas overwhelms him. Last year they went to Moshimi's parents' house. This year they'll go to Pemberton Road. He no longer looks forward to the holiday. He only wants to be on the other side of the season. His impatience makes him feel that he is incontrovertibly, finally, an adult. He wanders absently into a perfume store, a clothing store, a store that sells only bags. He has no idea what to get Moshimi for Christmas. Normally she drops hints, showing him catalogs, but he has no clue as to what she's coveting this season, if it's a new pair of gloves, or a wallet, or new pajamas she'd like. In the maze of stalls in Union Square that sell candles and shawls and handmade jewelry, nothing inspires him. He decides to try the Barnes & Noble at the northern edge of the square, but staring at the immense wall of new titles on display, he realizes he's read none of these books, and what was the point of giving her something he hadn't read? On his way out of the store, he pauses by a table devoted to travel guides. He picks up one for Italy, full of illustrations of the architecture he had studied so carefully as a student, has admired only in photographs, has always meant to see. It angers him, yet there's no one to blame but himself. What was stopping him? A trip together to a place neither of them has been. Maybe that's what he and Moshimi need. He could plan it all himself, select the cities they would visit, the hotels. It could be his Christmas gift to her, 2 airplane tickets tucked into the back of the guide. He was due for another vacation. He could plan it for her spring break. Inspired by the thought, he goes to the register, waits in a long line, and pays for the book. He walks across the park toward home, thumbing the book, anxious to see her now. He decides to stop off at the new gourmet grocery that's opened on Irvin Place to buy some of the things she likes. Blood oranges, a wedge of cheese from the Pyrenees, slices of soppressata, a loaf of peasant bread. For she will be hungry. They serve nothing on planes these days. He looks up from the book at the sky, at the darkness gathering, the clouds a deep, beautiful gold, and it's momentarily stopped by a flock of pigeons flying dangerously close. Suddenly terrified, he ducks his head, feeling foolish afterward. None of the other pedestrians has reacted. He stops and watches as the birds shoot up, then land simultaneously on 2 neighboring bare-branched trees. He is unsettled by the sight. He has seen these graceless birds on windowsills and sidewalks, but never in trees. It looks almost unnatural. And yet, what could be more ordinary? He thinks of Italy, of Venice, the trip he will begin to plan. Maybe it's a sign that they are meant to go there. Wasn't the Piazza San Marco famous for its pigeons? The lobby of the apartment is warm when he enters, the building's heat restored. "She just got back," the doorman tells Goggle with a wink as he walks past, and his heart leaps, unburdened of its malaise, grateful for her simple act of returning to him. He imagines her puttering around the apartment, drawing a bath, pouring herself a glass of wine, her bags in the hallway. He slips the book he will give her for Christmas into the pocket of his coat, making sure it's well concealed, and calls the elevator to take him upstairs. Chapter 12, 2000. It is the day before Christmas. Ashima Ganguly sits at her kitchen table, making mincemeat croquettes for a party she is throwing that evening. They are one of her specialties, something her guests have come to expect, handed to them on small plates within minutes of their arrival. Alone, she manages an assembly line of preparation. First, she forces warm, boiled potatoes through a ricer. Carefully, she shapes a bit of the potato around a spoonful of cooked ground lamb, as uniformly as the white of a hard-boiled egg encases its yolk. She dips each of the croquettes, about the size and shape of a billiard ball, into a bowl of beaten eggs, then coats them on a plate of breadcrumbs, shaking off the excess in her cupped palms. Finally, she stacks the croquettes on a large circular tray, a sheet of wax paper between each layer. She stops to count how many she's made so far. She estimates 3 for each adult, 1 or 2 for each of the children. Counting the lines on the back of her fingers, she reviews once more the exact number of her guests. Another dozen to be safe, she decides. She pours a fresh heap of breadcrumbs on the plate, their color and texture reminding her of sand on a beach. She remembers making the first batches in her kitchen in Cambridge for her very first parties, her husband at the stove in white drawstring pajamas and a t-shirt, frying the croquettes two at a time in a small blackened saucepan. She remembers Goggle and Sonia helping her when they were small, Goggle's hand wrapped around the can of crumbs, Sonia always wanting to eat the croquettes before they'd been breaded and fried. This will be the last party Ashima will host at Pemberton Road, the first since her husband's funeral. The house in which she has lived for the past 27 years, which she has occupied longer than any other in her life, has been recently sold, a realtor's sign stuck into the lawn. The buyers are an American family, the Walkers, a young professor new to the university where her husband used to work, and a wife and daughter. The Walkers are planning renovations. They will knock down the wall between the living and dining rooms, put an island in the kitchen, track lights overhead. They want to pull up the wall-to-wall carpeting, convert the sun deck into a den. Listening to their plans, Ashima had felt a moment's panic, a protective instinct, wanting to retract her offer, wanting the house to remain as it's always been, as her husband had last seen it. But this had been sentimentality speaking. It is foolish for her to hope that the golden letter spelling Ganguly on the mailbox will not be peeled off, replaced, that Sonia's name written in magic marker on the inside of her bedroom door will not be sanded, restained, that the pencil markings on the wall by the linen closet where Ashok used to record his children's height on their birthdays will not be painted over. Ashima has decided to spend 6 months of her life in India, 6 months in the States. It is a solitary, somewhat premature version of the future she and her husband had planned when he was alive. In Calcutta, Ashima will live with her younger brother Rana and his wife and their two grown, as yet unmarried daughters, in a spacious flat in Salt Lake. There she will have a room, the first in her life intended for her exclusive use. In spring and summer, she will return to the Northeast, dividing her time among her son, her daughter, and her close Bengali friends. True to the meaning of her name, she will be without borders, without a home of her own, a resident everywhere and nowhere. But it's no longer possible for her to live here now that Sonia is going to be married. The wedding will be in Calcutta, a little over a year from now, on an auspicious January day, just as she and her husband were married nearly 34 years ago. Something tells her Sonia will be happy with this boy. Quickly she corrects herself, this young man. He has brought happiness to her daughter, in a way Moshimi had never brought it to her son. That it was she who had encouraged Goggle to meet Moshimi will be something for which Ashima will always feel guilty. How could she have known? But fortunately, they have not considered it their duty to stay married, as the Bengalis of Ashok and Ashima's generation do. They are not willing to accept, to adjust, to settle for something less than their ideal of happiness. That pressure has given way, in the case of the subsequent generation, to American common sense. For a few final hours, she is alone in the house. Sonia has gone with Ben to pick up Goggle at the train station. It occurs to Ashima that the next time she will be by herself, she will be traveling, sitting on the plane. For the first time since her flight to meet her husband in Cambridge, in the winter of 1967, she will make the journey entirely on her own. The prospect no longer terrifies her. She has learned to do things on her own, and though she still wears saris, still puts her long hair in a bun, she is not the same Ashima who once lived in Calcutta. She will return to India with an American passport. In her wallet will remain her Massachusetts driver's license, her social security card. She will return to a world where she will not single-handedly throw parties for dozens of people. She will not have to go to the trouble of making yogurt from half and half and sandesh from ricotta cheese. She will not have to make her own croquettes. They will be available to her from restaurants, brought up to the flat by servants, bearing a taste that after all these years she has still not quite managed, to her entire satisfaction, to replicate. She finishes breading the final croquette, then glances at her wristwatch. She is slightly ahead of schedule. She sets the platter on the counter next to the stove. She takes a pan out of the cupboard and pours in the oil, several cupfuls, to be heated in the minutes before her guests are expected. From a crock she selects the slotted spatula she will use. For now there is nothing left to be done. The rest of the food has been prepared, sitting in long Corningware pans on the dining room table. Dal coated with a thick skin that will rupture as soon as the first of it is served. A roasted cauliflower dish, eggplant, a korma of lamb. Sweet yogurt and pantuas for dessert sit on the sideboard. She eyes everything with anticipation. Normally cooking for parties leaves her without an appetite, but tonight she looks forward to serving herself, sitting among her guests. With Sonia's help, the house has been cleaned one last time. Ashima has always loved these hours before a party. The carpets vacuumed, the coffee table wiped with pledge. Her dimmed, blurry reflection visible in the wood, just as the old television commercial used to promise. She roots through her kitchen drawer for a packet of incense. She lights a stick by the flame of the stove and walks from room to room. It's gratified her to go to all this effort, to make a final, celebratory meal for her children, her friends. To decide on a menu, to make a list, and shop in the supermarket, and fill the refrigerator shelves with food. It's a pleasant change of pace, something finite in contrast to her current, overwhelming, ongoing task, to prepare for her departure, picking the bones of the house clean. For the past month, she has been dismantling her household piece by piece. Each evening, she has tackled a drawer, a closet, a set of shelves. Though Sonia offers to help, Ashima prefers to do this alone. She has made piles of things to give to Gogol and Sonia, things to give to friends, things to take with her, things to donate to charities, things to put into trash bags and drive to the dump. The task both saddens and satisfies her at the same time. There is a thrill to whittling down her possessions to little more than what she'd come with, to those three rooms in Cambridge in the middle of a winter's night. Tonight she will invite friends to take whatever might be useful, lamps, plants, platters, pots and pans. Sonia and Ben will rent a truck and take whatever furniture they have room for. She goes upstairs to shower and change. The walls now remind her of the house when they first moved in, bare except for the photograph of her husband, which will be the last thing she will remove. She pauses for a moment, waving the remains of the incense in front of Ashok's image before throwing the stick away. She lets the water run in the shower, turns up the thermostat to compensate for the terrible moment when she will have to step onto the mat on the bathroom floor, unclothed. She gets into her beige bathtub, behind the crackled, sliding glass doors. She is exhausted from 2 days of cooking, from her morning of cleaning, from these weeks of packing and dealing with the sale of the house. Her feet feel heavy against the fiberglass floor of the tub. For a while, she simply stands there before tending to the shampooing of her hair, the soaping of her softening, slightly shrinking 53-year-old body, which she must fortify each morning with calcium pills. When she is finished, she wipes the steam off the bathroom mirror and steadies her face. A widow's face, but for most of her life, she reminds herself, a wife. And perhaps, one day, a grandmother, arriving in America, laden with hand-knit sweaters and gifts, leaving, a month or two later, inconsolable, in tears. Ashima feels lonely suddenly, horribly, permanently alone, and briefly, turned away from the mirror, she sobs for her husband. She feels overwhelmed by the thought of the move she is about to make, to the city that was once home and is now in its own way foreign. She feels both impatience and indifference for all the days she must still live, for something tells her she will not go as quickly as her husband did. For 33 years she missed her life in India. Now she will miss her job at the library, the women with whom she's worked. She will miss throwing parties. She will miss living with her daughter, the surprising companionship they have formed, going into Cambridge together to see old movies at the Brattle, teaching her to cook the food Sonia had complained of eating as a child. She will miss the opportunity to drive, as she sometimes does on her way home from the library, to the university, past the engineering building where her husband once worked. She will miss the country in which she has grown to know and love her husband. Though his ashes have been scattered into the Ganges, it is here, in this house, and in this town, that he will continue to dwell in her mind. She takes a deep breath. In a moment she will hear the beeps of the security system, the garage door opening, car doors closing, her children's voices in the house. She applies lotion to her arms and legs, reaches for a peach-colored terrycloth robe that hangs from a hook on the door. Her husband had given her the robe years ago, for a Christmas now long forgotten. This, too, she will have to give away, will have no use for where she is going. In such a humid climate, it would take days for such a thick material to dry. She makes a note to herself, to wash it well and donate it to the thrift shop. She does not remember the year she had gotten the robe, does not remember opening it, or her reaction. She knows only that it had been either Gogol or Sonia who had picked it out at one of the department stores at the mall, had wrapped it even. that all her husband had done was to write his name and hers on the to and from tag. She does not fault him for this. Such omissions of devotion, of affection, she knows now, do not matter in the end. She no longer wonders what it might have been like to do what her children have done, to fall in love first rather than years later, to deliberate over a period of months or years and not a single afternoon, which was the time it had taken for her and Ashok to agree to wed. It is the image of their two names on the tag that she thinks of, a tag she had not bothered to save. It reminds her of their life together, of the unexpected life he, in choosing to marry her, had given her here, which she had refused for so many years to accept. And though she still does not feel fully at home within these walls on Pemberton Road, she knows that this is home, nevertheless, the world for which she is responsible, which she has created, which is everywhere around her, needing to be packed up, given away, thrown out, bit by bit. She slips her damp arms into the sleeves of the robe, ties the belt around her waist. It's always been a bit short on her, a size too small. Its warmth is a comfort all the same. There is no one to greet Gogol on the platform when he gets off the train. He wonders if he's early, looks at his watch. Instead of going to the station house, he waits on a bench outside. The last of the passengers board, the train doors slide to a close. The conductors wave their signals to one another. The wheels roll slowly away. The compartments glide forward, one by one. He watches his fellow passengers being greeted by family members, lovers reunited with entangled arms, without a word. College students burdened by backpacks, returning for Christmas break. After a few minutes, the platform is empty, as is the space the train had occupied. Now Gogol looks onto a field, some spindly trees against a cobbled twilight sky. He thinks of calling home, but decides he is content to sit and wait a while longer. The cool air is pleasant on his face after his hours on the train. He'd slept most of the journey to Boston, the conductor poking him awake once they'd reached South Station, and he was the only person left in the compartment, the last to get off. He had slept soundly, curled up on two seats, his book unread, using his overcoat as a blanket, pulled up to his chin. He feels groggy still, a bit lightheaded from having skipped his lunch. At his feet are a duffel bag containing clothes, a shopping bag from Macy's with gifts bought earlier that morning before catching his train at Penn Station. His choices are uninspired. A pair of 14-carat gold earrings for his mother, sweaters for Sonia and Ben. They have agreed to keep things simple this year. He has a week of vacation. There is work to do at the house, his mother has warned him. His room must be emptied, every last scrap either taken back with him to New York or tossed. He must help his mother pack her things, settle her accounts. They will drive her to Logan and see her off as far as airport security will allow. And then the house will be occupied by strangers, and there will be no trace that they were ever there, no house to enter, no name in the telephone directory. Nothing to signify the years his family has lived there, no evidence of the effort, the achievement it had been. It's hard to believe that his mother is really going, that for months she will be so far. He wonders how his parents had done it, leaving their respective families behind, seeing them so seldom, dwelling unconnected in a perpetual state of expectation, of longing. All those trips to Calcutta he had once resented, how could they have been enough? They were not enough. Gogol knows now that his parents had lived their lives in America in spite of what was missing, with a stamina he fears he does not possess himself. He had spent years maintaining distance from his origins, his parents in bridging that distance as best they could. And yet, for all his aloofness towards his family in the past, his years at college and then in New York, he has always hovered close to this quiet, ordinary town that had remained, for his mother and father, stubbornly exotic. He had not traveled to France as Moshimi had, or even to California as Sonia had done. Only for 3 months was he separated by more than a few small states from his father, a distance that had not troubled Gogol in the least, until it was too late. Apart from those months, for most of his adult life, he has never been more than a 4-hour train ride away. And there was nothing, apart from his family, to draw him home, to make this train journey again and again. It had been on the train exactly a year ago that he'd learned of Moshimi's affair. They were on their way up to spend Christmas with his mother and Sonia. They had left the city late, and outside the windows it had been dark, the disturbing pitch black of early winter evenings. They were in the middle of a conversation about how to spend the coming summer, whether to rent a house in Siena with Donald and Astrid, an idea Gogol was resisting, when she'd said, "Dimitri says Siena is something out of a fairy tale." Immediately a hand had gone to her mouth, accompanied by a small intake of breath, and then silence. "Who's Dimitri?" he'd asked, and then, "Are you having an affair?" The question had sprung out of him, something he had not consciously put together in his mind until that moment. It felt almost comic to him, burning in his throat. But as soon as he asked it, he knew. He felt the chill of her secrecy numbing him, like a poison spreading quickly through his veins. He'd felt this way on only one other occasion, the night he had sat in the car with his father and learned the reason for his name. That night he'd experienced the same bewilderment, was sickened in the same way, but he felt none of the tenderness that he had felt for his father, only the anger, the humiliation of having been deceived. And yet at the same time he was strangely calm. In the moment that his marriage was effectively severed, he was on solid ground with her for the first time in months. He remembered a night weeks ago, looking through her bag for her wallet to pay the Chinese food delivery man, he'd pulled out her diaphragm case. She told him she'd gone to the doctor that afternoon to have it refitted, and so he'd put it out of his mind. His first impulse had been to get out at the next station, to be as physically far from her as possible. But they were bound together, by the train, by the fact that his mother and Sonia were expecting them. And so somehow they had suffered through the rest of the journey, and then through the weekend, telling no one, pretending that nothing was wrong. Lying in his parents' house, in the middle of the night, she told him the whole story, about meeting Dimitri on a bus, finding his resume in the bin. She confessed that Dimitri had gone with her to Palm Beach. One by one he stored the pieces of information in his mind, unwelcome, unforgivable, and for the first time in his life, another man's name upset Gogol more than his own. The day after Christmas she left Pemberton Road with the excuse to his mother and Sonia that a last-minute interview had fallen into place at MLA. But really the job was a ruse. She and Gogol had decided that it was best for her to return to New York alone. By the time he arrived at the apartment, her clothes were gone, and her makeup and her bathroom things. It was as if she were away on another trip. But this time she didn't come back. She wanted nothing of the brief life they'd had together, when she'd appeared one last time at his office a few months later, so that he could sign the divorce papers. She told him she was moving back to Paris. And so, systematically, as he had done for his dead father, he removed her possessions from the apartment, putting her books into boxes on the sidewalk in the middle of the night for people to take, throwing out the rest. In the spring, he went to Venice alone for a week, the trip he'd planned for the two of them, saturating himself in its ancient, melancholy beauty. He lost himself among the dark and narrow streets, crossing countless tiny bridges, discovering deserted squares where he had sat with a Campari or a coffee, sketching the facades of pink and green palaces and churches, unable ever to retrace his steps. And then he returned to New York, to the apartment they'd inhabited together that was now all his. A year later, the shock had worn off, but a sense of failure and shame persists, deep and abiding. There are nights he still falls asleep on the sofa without deliberation, waking up at 3 a.m. with the television still on. It is as if a building he'd been responsible for designing has collapsed for all to see, and yet he can't really blame her. They had both acted on the same impulse. That was their mistake. They had both sought comfort in each other, and in their shared world, perhaps for the sake of novelty, or out of the fear that that world was slowly dying. Still, he wonders how he's arrived at all this, that he is 32 years old and already married and divorced. His time with her seems like a permanent part of him that no longer has any relevance or currency, as if that time were a name he had ceased to use. He hears the familiar beep of his mother's car, spots it pulling into the parking lot. Sonia is sitting in the driver's seat waving. Ben is next to her. This is the first time he's seen Sonia since she and Ben have announced their engagement. He decides he will ask her to stop off at a liquor store so he can buy some champagne. She steps out of the car, walking toward him. She's an attorney now, working in an office in the Hancock building. Her hair is cut to her jaw. She's wearing an old blue down jacket that Gogol had worn back in high school. And yet there is a new maturity in her face. He can easily imagine her, a few years from now, with two children in the back seat, She gives him a hug. For a moment they stand there with their arms around each other in the cold. "Welcome home, Goggles," she says. For the last time, they assemble the artificial 7-foot tree, the branches color-coded at their base. Goggle brings up the box from the basement. For decades, the instructions have been missing. Each year, they have to figure out the order in which the branches must be inserted. The longest ones at the bottom, the smallest at the top. Sonia holds the pole, and Goggle and Ben insert the branches. The orange go first, then the yellow, then the red, and finally blue, the uppermost piece slightly bent under the white speckled ceiling. They place the tree in front of the window, drawing apart the curtains so that people passing by the house can see, as excited as they were when they were children. They decorate it with ornaments made by Sonia and Goggle in elementary school, construction paper candlesticks, popsicle stick god's eyes, glitter-covered pine cones. A torn Banarasi sari of Ashima's is wrapped around the base. At the top they put what they always do, a small plastic bird covered with turquoise velvet, with brown wire claws. Stockings are hung on nails from the mantel, the one put up for Moshimi last year now put up for Ben. They drink the champagne out of styrofoam cups, forcing Ashima to have some too, and they play the Pericoma Christmas tape his father always liked. They tease Sonia, telling Ben about the year she had refused her gifts after taking a Hinduism class in college, coming home and protesting that they weren't Christian. Early in the morning, his mother, faithful to the rules of Christmas her children had taught her when they were little, will wake up and fill the stockings with gift certificates to record stores, candy canes, mesh bags of chocolate coins. He can still remember the very first time his parents had had a tree in the house, at his insistence, a plastic thing no larger than a table lamp, displayed on top of the fireplace mantel. And yet its presence had felt colossal, how it had thrilled him. He had begged them to buy it from the drugstore. He remembers decorating it clumsily with garlands and tinsel and a string of lights that made his father nervous. In the evenings, until his father came in and pulled out the plug, causing the tiny tree to go dark, Goggle would sit there. He remembers the single wrapped gift that he had received, a toy that he had picked out himself, his mother asking him to stand by the greeting cards while she paid for it. "Remember when we used to put on those awful flashing colored lights?" his mother says now when they are done, shaking her head. "I didn't know a thing back then." At 7:30 the bell rings, and the front door is left open as people in cold air stream into the house. Guests are speaking in Bengali, hollering, arguing, talking on top of one another, the sound of their laughter filling the already crowded rooms. The croquettes are fried in crackling oil and arranged with a red onion salad on plates. Sonia serves them with paper napkins. Ben, the Jamai-to-be, is introduced to each of the guests. "I'll never keep all these names straight," he says at one point to Goggle. "Don't worry, you'll never need to," Goggle says. These people, these honorary aunts and uncles of a dozen different surnames, have seen Goggle grow, have surrounded him at his wedding, his father's funeral. He promises to keep in touch with them now that his mother is leaving, not to forget them. Sonia shows off her ring, 6 tiny diamonds surrounding an emerald, to the Mashis who wear their red and green saris. "You will have to grow your hair for the wedding," they tell Sonia. One of the Meshos is sporting a Santa hat. They sit in the living room, on the furniture and on the floor. Children drift down into the basement, the older ones to rooms upstairs. He recognizes his old Monopoly game being played, the board in 2 pieces, the race car missing ever since Sonia dropped it into the baseboard heater when she was little. Goggle does not know to whom these children belong. Half the guests are people his mother has befriended in recent years, people who are at his wedding, but whom he does not recognize. People talk of how much they've come to love Ashima's Christmas Eve parties, that they've missed them these past few years, that it won't be the same without her. They've come to rely on her, Goggle realizes, to collect them together, to organize the holiday, to convert it, to introduce the tradition to those who are new. It has always felt adopted to him, an accident of circumstance, a celebration not really meant to be. And yet it was for him, for Sonia, that his parents had gone to the trouble of learning these customs. It was for their sake that it had come to all this. In so many ways, his family's life feels like a string of accidents, unforeseen, unintended, one incident begetting another. It had started with his father's train wreck, paralyzing him at first, later inspiring him to move as far as possible, to make a new life on the other side of the world. There was the disappearance of the name Goggle's great-grandmother had chosen for him, lost in the mail somewhere between Calcutta and Cambridge. This had led, in turn, to the accident of his being named Goggle, defining and distressing him for so many years. He had tried to correct that randomness,